Welcome to the Lindman News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Irving Wesley Hall. Irving is a longtime activist. He's also taught English, political science, philosophy, economics, history. My goodness, just about everything at California and New York colleges. Most recently, American history and research methods at the State University of New York at Morrisville. We have a lot to talk about in the hour, at least a couple of topics, and we can reach in almost anything. Two distinguished men died last week, a day apart. I put out a new article this morning on one of them, Howard Zinn, and the other man was J.D. Salinger, famous author, famous novelist. Oh, wrote Catcher in the Rye that I read decades back. We want to talk about them, and maybe we can get into Obama's State of the Union message as well. I had something to say about that. Indeed, I could not let that pass, or Howard Zinn's passing. Irving, I welcome you to the program. I was so involved with so much this morning, racing literally to within 2 or 3 minutes of the top of the hour, that I meant to send you my article on Howard Zinn. Well, I think I did send it in bulk. But if I didn't, I will send it to you. I did it over the weekend. I was asked to do it, but I really wanted to do it once I thought about it. So I did, but we want to talk about him and J.D. Salinger. Welcome, Irving. It's been a long time. I'm happy to have you back.
It's great to be back with you, Steve. I look forward to reading your article.
Oh, I usually, when I do them, Irving, you know, what are you going to say about a guy who passed away? You could make it short. I just couldn't do that. I wanted to get everything in it that I could. And, well, you'll see when you take a look at it. I try to let him use a lot of his own words because they sure could explain the kind of man he was better than anybody else, certainly better than I can do it. And as I read through and edited, well, I didn't edit his words, but as I read through the words of his that I chose, oh, they just moved me so much. That really was the way I could do it best, with some of my own comments interspersed. And then later on, I had a lot more say. But anyway, let's talk about those two men. I will tell you this. I was astonished when I checked J.D. Salinger to find out, I can't believe this number is right, that Catcher in the Rye, so over the years, he wrote it many decades ago, sold 65 million copies. Can that possibly be right?
That's the same figure that I have, and Howard Zinn's People's History, which was published, of course, 30 years later, has sold 4 million. There's one thing, and only one thing that I can think of that they would both agree with. This is a quote from Holden Caulfield in Catcher in the Rye. "Boy, when you're dead, they really fix you up. I hope to hell when I do die, somebody has sense enough to just dump me in the river or something. Anything except sticking me in a goddamn cemetery. People coming and putting a bunch of flowers on your stomach on Sunday and all that crap. Who wants flowers when you're dead? Nobody."
Oh, I love that. It's been too long since I read it, Irving, so I don't remember anything in the book. I read it back, I'm guessing, in the 1950s. And
It had a profound effect on us. It really resonated. And it meant a lot to me, the significance of both of them dying, incidentally, on the same day. I was wrong when I suggested they were
on
day
the
apart.
Same day.
Both on the 27th, and just days before the February's Black History Month and the 50th anniversary of the sit-ins in the South, and the coming up on May 13th, the 50th anniversary of May 13th, 1960 protests against the House Committee on Un-American Activities in San Francisco, in which 64 people were arrested.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Back on with Irving Wesley Hall, talking about Howard Zinn, J.D. Salinger, I, just in case, to be sure you got it, Irving, I just shot you my Zen article again. In it, I had 2 million copies sold. I did not realize that the latest I got on a publisher's website was 2 million. So I guess they stopped counting, or I didn't get the most up-to-date page to get the accurate count. But I mean, it's as good a bestseller now as it was many years ago.
Well, the death propelled Thatcher and the Rye to the fifth today on the New York Times bestseller list, and People's History is sixth.
Oh, my goodness.
Those of us who were politically active in the 60s, at least those who were in my generation, because I was 24 in May 1960, and I think we were very much influenced, not so much by Salinger himself, but by the sensibility behind his work. Because he didn't influence so much as he just resonated. If you'll recall, the 50s was the period of the great economic boom, the Eisenhower period, the post-war boom, the flowering of American industry, the domination of the world by the United States after the devastation of Europe and Asia. And while there was some celebration of that in the middle class and the suburbs, and of course, all of that kind of happy development, TV sitcoms with Leave It to Beaver, et cetera, the alienation of the youth was an undertow that Catcher in the Rye really captured, I think. And when we read it for the first time, we just felt it. It was a profound alienation. You later found it in the film portrayals by James Dean and Marlon Brando, and it later expressed itself in the late 50s with the San Francisco Renaissance, the Beat Generation, and Allen Ginsberg's Howl, and it was expressed in just a profound alienation from society. Existentialism as a philosophy was very popular in the 50s. I went to Stanford, and there were refugees from Europe, both Germans and French professors, who taught us existentialism, which was also related to that kind of sense of alienation, that there really is no external meaning in life, whether it's religion or values or anything else. They're all primarily creations. And one chooses one's reality, and one chooses one's values. They don't exist. They exist in society, but they do not exist outside of society. In other words, if the world were destroyed, God would no longer exist, because he's a creation of man. All of the values that human beings hold would simply be gone with them. And it was a pessimistic philosophy on the one hand, but on the other hand, it became a very liberating philosophy. It allowed people to examine newly the values that they inherited, and to step aside from them. Of course, Catcher in the Rye simply just rejects them in a very adolescent, very unreflective kind of way. And that was really the 50s, as far as I remember it. We were very cynical. We made fun of Eisenhower. We didn't have much hope. There was no real notion of political activism as we understand it today. The Communist Party was sharply persecuted by McCarthyism. The labor activists, civil rights activists, civil liberties activists were driven underground and marginalized by the great celebration of American exceptionalism, American prosperity. And people just stewed, and that was really Holden Caulfield. And that J.D. Salinger could live his life according to his book by simply reclusing himself in Cornish, New Hampshire for the rest of his life and primarily avoiding people, producing very little literature after that of any significance. And to have Howard Zinn, who is the absolute opposite of that, die on the same day, 4 years younger, just seems so remarkable to me. Because when we protested against the House Committee in San Francisco on May 13th, 1960, we were hosed down by water hoses unleashed by the head of the Red Squad for attempting to get into the hearings of the House Committee on Un-American Activities. It was a complete break from the 50s. It was a complete break from that kind of alienation and distance and lack of empowerment. And Howard Zinn, of course, in his life and his work, reflected that rebellion. He was part of the 60s rebellion and activism long before he wrote People's History in 1980. As you know, he was a phenomenal man in terms of his life in the late 50s, a period we're talking about, before the sit-downs. He was fired from Spelman College for siding with the students who were becoming active against segregation, Jim Crow in the South. And then later went on to be one of the two emissaries of the peace movement to go to North Vietnam in the late 60s to pick up two of the released prisoners of war. Daniel Ellsberg turned to him when he wanted somebody who would safely take care of his Pentagon papers while he was trying to get them published. And Zinn also helped Daniel Berrigan, who was responsible for burning the draft files in Pennsylvania. He helped him escape the authorities. And it was a phenomenal life that was unified with the major theme of his work, which was that little acts by small people are what make change. And that's the best one could say in reaction to Obama's State of the Union message.
Well, to me, Zinn is somebody who exuded hope. He absolutely rebelled against the system. You do, I do. My recollections of how I felt back in the 1950s, I was not particularly active back at that time. I was no fan of Eisenhower, for sure. Given the kind of Republicans we've had that came after him, I would sure trade a George Bush for a Dwight Eisenhower. And but I was no fan of his. But I agree, the 50s, we were really king of the hill back. The USA was king of the hill back then. But we had the horrible stuff going on. We had McCarthyism and the House Un-American Activities Committee going after anybody on the left and anybody who did buck the system and noted injustices and wanted them a change because they should be changed. And that really isn't an issue of left or right. It's an issue of justice or injustice. Sadly, it's only gotten worse since back at that time. We may not have...
The remarkable thing about the 1960 protest was that McCarthy, by that time as an individual, had been discredited by his peers in the Senate and, of course, talked down by the Secretary of the Army in famous hearings that were broadcast on television, which, of course, really began developed a mass audience only in the late 50s.
Can I tell you one thing? I saw that broadcast when oh, my goodness, the lawyer, what was the lawyer's name? That took on McCarthy.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about. I can't.
Oh yeah. Oh God, I know his name so well, and I can't think of it. But I saw that. I was living. I was in college. I was living at home, and I came back after class, and I knew the hearings were on. I just turned it on, and I happened to watch some of that day's broadcast, and saw that confrontation between the lawyer and Joe McCarthy. And he really, he just stopped McCarthy cold. That may have been a turning point, but, you know, McCarthy taking on the U.S. Army, I think that was the turning point. You do not take on the power establishment. You can go after the Hollywood people. You can go after individuals, but you don't take on anybody or any institution that's part of the power structure. So McCarthy went a little bit too far, and it was his undoing.
Well, he was also biting the hand that fed him. McCarthyism is often understood only superficially. It was at the same time an anti-communist crusade and a witch hunt, often against people who had nothing to do with communism at all. But that in itself was the propaganda cover for the development of the military-industrial complex. Communism just happened to be a good enemy at that time. Once the Soviet Union collapsed, the military-industrial complex needed a new enemy, and all of a sudden it became Islam. And so it was, in a way, it was the arm of that section of American capital attempting to defend its domination of the economy by demonizing communists and communism. And we could get into that at some point. I debated William F. Buckley on that issue in 1961. And the Communist Party was absolutely no threat to the United States whatsoever. In fact, two of its, and we're getting a little bit sidetracked here, but it's a fascinating point, that two of its Central Committee members, the Sobel brothers, they spelled their last name differently. One was S-O-B-L-E and the other one B-L-E. They were on the Central Committee of the Communist Party. They were so trusted by the party, they were the ones who were sent to the Soviet Union to pick up contributions to the party from the American Party, from the Soviet Union, and they were both FBI informers. So the FBI knew exactly what the Communist Party was doing. It knew it was no threat. It was a spent force after the 30s and the late 40s. But it was a ideal whipping point, a whipping boy, because the communists, and you have to give them, I was never attracted to Stalinism or communism, but the members of the Communist Party were very active in civil rights, in peace, in civil liberties, and they were very small in number and very lacking in influence, but it was very easy to attack the peace movement.
Those are the issues, Irving. We need to take another break. Joe Welch,
okay.
The lawyer.
Yep, Joseph Welch.
Oh,
this is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back. I'm with Irving Wesley Hall, talking about two icons, J.D. Salinger, Howard Zinn. Oh, let me let you add what more is important on this, and then maybe get bring it to the present, to Irving, and
well,
we were talking about
McCarthyism and the way in which the spirit of Howard Zinn eventually rebelled against all of that mind-numbing conformity and worship of the great leaders as the primary movers of history, and how the experience that I had on May 13th, 1960 in San Francisco lifted me out of the alienation that was characterized and best captured by Holden Caulfield in Catcher in the Rye. And there was, of course, nothing particularly political about Holden Caulfield, but it was very political in the sense that it simply encouraged people to give up and become apathetic, because there was really no way of engaging with society, which of course was the absolute antithesis of the life and work of Howard Zinn. And we were talking about McCarthyism, because it was really not only anti-communism, which was the cover and the propaganda device to allow the military-industrial complex to dominate our society, which it does economically. But it was also class war. They wiped out the union movement. The militant union movement was destroyed by McCarthyism long before we tackled the House Committee on Un-American Activities in San Francisco in 1960. But we came at it from a different standpoint, and we came at it from the standpoint, and again, it was very engaged, very anti-Holden Caulfield, very preparatory for Howard Zinn, whose work came later, although, as I say, he was active in the civil rights struggle long before it became fashionable. And that was the issue of the First Amendment and the idea that the United States was founded upon the notion that people had to be free to speak their minds and to discuss issues, formulate solutions, deal with problems, and there had to be a complete freedom of that exchange of ideas without any restraint on left or right. In this case, restraint on communists, who were simply demonized as one extreme of the ideological spectrum. And that's the way we came into it. When I remember debating William F. Buckley in 1961, and I had some respect for him as a conservative, but I was appalled by his approach. it was almost like he was taken off guard that we were going to talk about the First Amendment to the Constitution, freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of assembly. And he wanted to talk about the communist conspiracy, which even at that time I knew was a red herring. It was a fraud. There was no danger from the Communist Party internally or externally is a different issue. That's a whole program for you. So when we tackled UAC, we were not fully politicized, but the event itself, getting arrested, the 64 of us, mostly students from the University of California, Berkeley, San Francisco State, although we're also students from San Jose, high school students. Some notable people, incidentally, Evelyn Einstein, the great granddaughter of Albert Einstein, is one of the people, one of the students you'll see in Operation Abolition, which was a propaganda film that grew out of the demonstration and took on a whole second phase after the arrest of the 64 of us in the trial. But the House Committee on Un-American Activities itself was very important from both the standpoint of civil rights and civil liberties, because the people who served on that McCarthyite committee were a combination of Southern racist Dixiecrats and Northern Republican racists and anti-unionists. So you had a group of the most reactionary congressmen, and in many cases on both sides of that issue, white and Northern and Southern, they were Democrats. The Democrats in the South who were open racists, and that anti-union Democrats in the North, which were secretly racist, sometimes not so much so, they got John F. Kennedy elected and created enormous problems. If anybody watched Democracy Now! This morning, you realize it created enormous problems for JFK, because once the civil rights movement took off in the South, he simply wanted to squelch it because he did not want to destroy a major base of support, which was the Democratic Party in the South, which controlled the South at that time. This was before the subsequent period of the Republican Party realizing that the South had changed and they began to take over, and they destroyed the power of the Democratic Party and became the new racists. So when we confronted those five congressmen in San Francisco on their road trip from Washington to come and find communist influence in the labor movement and among students and civil rights and peace activists in the San Francisco area, we were confronting an alliance that was going to eventually break up, and I think we had something to do with that. And it was really an awakening. It was certainly inspired by the Southern sit-ins, which had begun again in February. We're talking about May 13th, 1960. Civil rights movement had begun with the sit-ins in Greensboro, North Carolina, on February 1st, as I recall, of that year. And the one thing we shared was a commitment to nonviolence. And the other thing that we shared was the necessity for social change coming out of this Holden Caulfield alienated, there's nothing we can do about the world zeitgeist of the 1950s. And there had been some political activity in Berkeley before that time, but not much.
Good enough break, Irving.
Okay. I want to talk more about the hearings when we come back.
Okay. It's important to know the House Un-American Activities Committee began in 1938. It was not a creation of the 1950s. It had been around a long while. Anyway, we'll be right. It's changed. It's now the House Judiciary Committee. Anyway.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back. I'm with Irving Wesley Hall. Irving, whenever I do an article, it's... Well, let's just take the one I did about Howard Zinn. It's mostly about Zinn, but I can't resist putting some of me into my articles as well. And I did this in the Zinn article, and I reflected. I forgot exactly how he addressed this, his People's History, which, of course, is his famous book and the millions of copies that it sold. I think the latest edition, I think it runs over 700 pages, and it's an easy read. Listeners who never read that book, he goes up, I forget how far into the Bush administration, there were numerous new editions of the book that came out, but I know the latest one gets into the new millennium under George Bush, which is the way I phrased it. How far into his administration, I don't recall exactly. I may not have the most current edition, but over the years I bought four or five copies of that book when a new edition would come out. And I'd give the old editions away. I think I still have a couple on my bookshelf, but I'd give the older editions away. And I forgot exactly how, I didn't go back and check, is what I'm saying. I didn't go back and check how we addressed the Founding Fathers and the creation that they came up with in Philadelphia, 1787. But I had to get something in about that, and I consider the First Amendment the most important right in the Constitution. But if you go back and you examine what these people had in mind in Philadelphia, they did not establish a democracy for we the people, as the Constitution so reads. What they had in mind had nothing to do with we the people, including the Bill of Rights. It's really a disturbing truth, Irving, that everything they put in the Constitution was to be a document, including the Bill of Rights, that was 4 years later, not 1787. It wasn't ratified until 1791. And it was a compromise. And it was to give them benefits. I used 15% of the population. But the people who assemble in Philadelphia, they were the same kind of folks that run things today. They were politicians. They were merchants. They were lawyers. Today we call them a Wall Street crowd. That's exactly the kind of people they were, and there was only one man who held the whole assemblage together. I didn't mention that, but it was George Washington, and the idea that James Madison was the founder of the Constitution is one of those great myths, which he certainly was not. But he performed a marvelous thing in Philadelphia. He was kind of new at the game back then. He was important enough to get invited, Irving, but he did one thing. He kept notes. And the only way we really know what went on in Philadelphia was from the notes that he kept, that were kept secret, I think, until after he died. And then
kept secret for 20 years by common consent.
Well, for a good number of years. And then finally they came out, and we had this account that I hope was accurate of what actually took place there. But I think what is accurate is these guys put together the kind of country they wanted to serve them. And I love quoting John Jay, the first Supreme Court justice of the country. I did it in this article. I've done it several times before. He believed that the country should be run by the people who own it. Well, the people, the 55 delegates in Philadelphia, were some of the people who owned it. So the only people who really got rights out of the Constitution were about, say, at most 15% of the population. The usual ones are excluded. If you weren't a property owner, you were excluded. Women were excluded. Of course, Native Americans were excluded. And blacks weren't even people. They were property. Well, I could go on and on, but let me let you pick it up.
Well, you know, the fascinating, we're getting into the question of civil liberties and civil rights and the First Amendment. Civil rights is, of course, the right to vote, the right to be free from discrimination on the basis of your race or sexuality or whatever else. Civil liberties is the principle that came out of that body of men. Again, it was an elite body of men, but it began all the way back with the Magna Carta, and that is the notion that certain people, rather than the king, had rights, and that the best way to run a society, even if you had a small elite, was to allow that elite fully to discuss issues rather than having it dictated by one individual, one fallible individual. And so the whole idea of freedom of speech, freedom of press, and freedom of assembly, yes, as you say, it was limited to the elite, primarily the northern businessmen and the southern slave owners, the plantation owners. But the idea itself, even though it was restricted to a few people, became expanded through time, as did civil rights. It expanded through time, and Zinn would be the one to go to understand how this happened in detail, through popular struggles. And the very idea, and Jefferson is, with all of the criticism that we can make of him as a slave owner and as an elitist, as you've just done, Nevertheless, he had the conception of the value of the mind. He was an amateur scientist, and he believed that that investigation and analysis and debate were the best way to arrive at the truth. And that, as an idea, expanded beyond the elite, again, through the struggles of individuals. And I think our struggle against McCarthyism in 1960 played a very, very important role in that, just as the civil rights struggle did in the South. Through those struggles of anonymous, often anonymous people, the ideas, the valuable ideas that were valuable to a small group of people became valuable for the entire society. And that's the way that human progress takes place, through struggles from the bottom, but also often implementing valuable ideas that come from the elite with their own vested interests.
Absolutely.
And,
Irving, the ideas were there. Then it's important for activists like you and many others to pick up on them and actually say, we want this stuff implemented. I mean, you wrote these words down on paper. Well, you know, they mean nothing on a piece of paper. You have to implement them and make it the system. We need the system, not words on a piece of paper. But you found out what happened to you when you went out there. The power structure went after you very mean and nastily.
Well, it did, but you know, those of us, there were differences. Yes, the civil rights struggle, freedom of, you know, the right to vote, the right against discrimination, and then the whole struggle for complete freedom of speech and ending the anti-communist attacks on people for having certain ideas rather than other ideas. There are two different streams, and they tended to come together in 1960. But the stakes were very different. The people in the South were beaten up. People were killed in the South. When the 64 of us were arrested protesting the House Committee and the fact that we were excluded from the hearings in May 1960, the stakes were not so high. We were liberated in a way because we had been so alienated. There had been that gap in the 50s between the activists of the 30s and the 40s and us. There was a gap. There was a healthy gap because we didn't have the fear. We didn't have the fear in San Francisco. I have to tell you an amusing story about that. One of the activists at the time, after it was all over with, of course, there's a great fear among people that they would be subpoenaed by the House Committee on Un-American Activities throughout the 50s, that you would be grilled, that you would be asked to identify your friends, that you would be asked what your political beliefs were and who you associated with. And it would lead to blacklisting. It would lead to your losing your job. It would lead to your being ostracized by your community. And we were free from all of that. There was something about that alienation, the James Dean, the Marlon Brando, total alienation from the society, that was very liberating. And we didn't have that fear. And if you look at the demonstrators in the film Operation Abolition or the ACLU's later film Operation Correction, both of which are now online, you can get all the details, by the way, by going to our website, www.notinkansas.us. If you look at the films, there was a certain fearlessness. There was a nonviolence, but there was a certain fearlessness among the students. And one of my colleagues who was active in the demonstrations and later when we formed the Bay Area Student Committee for the Abolition of the House Committee on Un-American Activities, probably the longest name of any organization in human history, we had fantasies about being called before the House Committee. And she said that she had this dream one night that she was called up by the House Committee in San Francisco, then chaired by Edmund Willis, who was this vicious racist from Mississippi with this southern gentlemanly kind of drawl. And she said if I were subpoenaed, they would give her name, let's say Ellen Brown. And she'd come to the hearings dressed in a widow's outfit with a black veil and a black dress. And when they called her name, instead of coming up kind of defiantly like the communists did or the people who are being accused of communists, and I respect that, she would rush to the front of the room and she would say, Edwin, after all we've meant to each other, how could you do this to me? And it was such a liberating experience to think of spoofing them rather than falling into the trap of being the victim. And most of us were very disappointed that we never were subpoenaed because we had been successful. The road trip to San Francisco in 1960 was the last of the House committees coming out of Washington to wreak havoc politically in communities throughout the country, mostly those that were most politically active, such as San Francisco. That was the last road trip. Within a matter of years, the House committee became an ineffectual body in Congress and was eventually abolished in the early 70s, long after it had lost its bite. So there was an effectiveness there that came from the kind of new generation of youth. And the same thing, of course, happened with the Southern black students and their white supporters. There was a kind of a liberation that came with a new generation, that there was a lack of fear. There was a break from the past, and it made possible a new form of resistance based upon the resistance that had come before that was had the possibility of a mass base. It was infectious. It was no longer kind of incestuous because it had been reduced to impotence by the powers of the military-industrial complex and McCarthyism and all of the other forces in the society that tried to eliminate dissent, eliminated people fighting for their rights. So it was a very exciting time. And the House committee made the big mistake of producing this film that I've alluded to before, which is now online, called Operation Abolition. Again, you can find out about it on our website, www.notinkansas.us. And they put out this propaganda film that would have done Joseph Goebbels in Nazi Germany honors. He would have been delighted with it. And they took clippings from the local TV stations and they reformulated them in order to create the notion that the students who had participated in these demonstrations on the basis of a commitment to civil rights, civil liberties, and the First Amendment, we were somehow dumb dupes of the communists, and that the communists had manipulated us, that the communists had this grand plan to recruit the nation's youth in order to destroy these great bastions of protection of freedom like the House Committee on Un-American Activities. And that film was shown the film was produced about 4 or 5 months after the hearings, and the House Committee and its right-wing supporters, John Birchers, the Young Americans for Freedoms, they thought, oh boy, this is great. We'll really take advantage of this. These students rioted. Incidentally, there was no riot. It was a nonviolent protest, even when the hoses were turned on people at the top of the stairs, marble stairs in San Francisco City Hall, which is now famous as the place where gay people get married. But they produced this film, and they started showing the John Birchers and the Young Americans for Freedom and the other kind of right with the American Legion, et cetera, would take these to college campuses throughout the community, and they'd show this film to try to prepare the students for the fact that the communists were out to recruit them to become, a fifth column in the United States. And instead of being properly tutored by the film, the students were inspired, whether it was in Illinois or the South or any place in the country, wherever that film was brought onto a college campus, it energized college students and played a major role in the development of the 60s student movement. The operation, film operation, based upon our demonstration and this distortion of it through this anti-communist propaganda film, became a major spark for the creation of the student movement that in Berkeley, of course, led in 1964 to the free speech movement, which involved many of the veterans of the earlier 60s demonstration, the 1960 demonstration. So it was a vindication, really, of the spirit of American rebellion. And of course, Howard Zinn became part of this and later used that particular approach of ordinary people taking up arms ideologically, politically against tyranny to inspire many, many future generations to see American history in that light.
Irving, during that time, we had, of course, the great anti-war activism, and Zinn was so prominent in that. He was really a leader in that, and he wrote the first book, Logic for Withdrawal from Vietnam. That was the first book to really address the idea that this war absolutely is insane and we have to get out. And I've got the book sitting on my shelf. I read it long ago. I must add, too, that even though this outrageous committee, the HUAC committee, is only oh, it's a lot more than a footnote in history, but it's something passed that no longer exists. Again, now it's the House Judiciary Committee. But the persecutions never stop, Irving. We had the FBI's COINTELPRO, and now instead of communists as enemy number one, we have Muslims and terrorists, and the FBI has been a ruthless persecutor of innocent people. I have written 25 or more articles on individuals that the FBI has gone after, mostly Muslims. Every single one of them, an innocent person, framed by the FBI, and the prosecutors are so clever. They intimidate juries to convict innocent people on the theory that we really don't think this person is guilty, but we may be wrong, so we dare not let a terrorist out in our neighborhood. And not all, but nearly every single one of these people gets convicted unjustly, and this goes on all the time. Every time you see a headline, and the headlines are prominent, where so-and-so was named planning to do this or planning to do that. And the latest one was the so-called underwear bomber on this airplane. There was an absolute setup. This guy actually had nothing whatsoever to bring down an aircraft, and he was used as an unwitting dupe. Oh, he may have had it in for the U.S., but he was used as an unwitting dupe. And the idea was to create this bogus scheme, going after Obama at the same time, Irving, that he was not God. How did this guy ever get on the plane in the first place? Well, you've got the CIA involved. Apparently, Israel's Mossad was involved. And I saw something that the Indian intelligence service was involved in this as well. It was all a setup. It was nothing. Oh, another break. I'll let you finish up. I get started, Irving. It's hard to stop. But you and I both are equally outraged at all this stuff going on, which is the reason I do what I do. And
corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back. Final segment with Irving Wesley Hall. Fascinating stuff, Irving. I am really fascinated. And your personal involvement with all of this, you telling me stuff I didn't realize. I knew you were activist back then, but I didn't realize you were doing so much in these places. And you also once had a confrontation directly with Ronald Reagan when he was governor, I believe.
Oh, yes. The photograph and the transcript are all on my website, www.notinkansas.us. And it's been a heavy conversation, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I'd like to speak in favor of having a sense of humor. That's one of the things we learned in the 60s. There was a certain lightness. Perhaps it was because we came out of the alienated 50s that we were able to step back from time to time and have a sense of humor. And I know what prompted you inviting me was my article, The Butthole Bomber, Dick Cheney's Next Terrorist.
Oh, indeed.
Which we got sidetracked. Yeah, which is the ultimate spoof of the whole airline fear industry that has grown up and developed over this incident on Christmas Day. And if you want to read the article, it's on Countercurrents. You can find a link to it on my website. and also to the Einstein Sisters Bag the Flying Monkey, my comic novel on the theft of the 2000 election, which starred Maxine Einstein, the great-great-granddaughter of Albert Einstein, who in many ways in the novel develops out of the Holden Caulfield alienation into a wonderful political activist, and in the course of the novel prevents the theft of the election in Florida in 2000. So let's keep a sense of humor. In many ways, that's the only thing that keeps me sane from time to time. And I would invite people to go to the website. The book, by the way, is on sale on Amazon because of the a few returns after Christmas for as low as $6. So people might grab them up while they can. And if you want to find out more about the novel and my biography politically, again, go to www.notincansas.us. And I thoroughly enjoyed the show, Steve. I hope I can come back.
Oh, Irving, I absolutely want you to come back. I'm going to shoot you an email as soon as we go off air and shoot a date at you. I mean, I can't bear to end this conversation. I'm so enthralled in everything you're talking about and a few things that I could throw in. We didn't even get to Obama's State of the Union.
Right.
But
which is probably just as well.
Well, it was pretty pathetic, case closed.
Yeah. But I am working on a memoir about the UAC demonstrations, Operation Abolition, and my debating throughout Southern California and the California area on the issue right after the arrests. And if anybody listening to this knows anybody who was arrested at that time or who was active at that time in Northern California, I'd love to hear from them because I'm trying to get something printed before the 50th anniversary on May 13th, 2010.
I don't know of anybody arrested, I must admit, but they sure were plenty. I've read about plenty, but I don't know anybody personally.
Well, your old friend Jim Petras was there. If you look at Operation Abolition, you can see him demonstrating with a placard outside City Hall. He wasn't one of those demonstrating, but he was active. I mentioned Evelyn Einstein. Rich Boyle, who later became
a
war movement.
We are out of time. They're going to cut us off. Oh, I've just got time to thank Irving for coming on. We absolutely have to pick this up again and have another chapter of this incredible conversation.
Thank you.
Many, many thanks, Irving, and please join us again tomorrow. We'll have another important discussion, a crucial one for me, big issue going on right now. Make it a daily habit and stay tuned for Ernie Hancock.